Well, it's the millennium. It finally came here. I can remember as a kid, you know, trying to figure out whether I'd still be alive when the millennium came. And it's absolutely astounding to me how fast that time went. And then all of a sudden, here it is. It's the year 2000. And when you think about it, it really is a phenomenal situation for us. Because at the beginning of this millennium, 1,000 years ago, Genghis Khan hadn't even been born yet. So the whole invasion of Europe hadn't taken place. The societies in Europe were still in the Dark Ages. The Crusades were still going on to some extent or another. The great Muslim hordes controlled the East. The Moors had invaded Spain. It was an area totally different than what we have now. And all this took place within the period of 1,000 years. And it's also the beginning of the century. It's a centennial celebration. And if you think back in the last 100 years, all the things that have happened in the last 100 years, aviation, radio, television, the atomic age entered into existence, automobiles, the central heating, the introduction of the electric light, all the things that we take for granted 100 years ago basically were non-existent. One of the things that did exist 100 years ago was the fact that we had the introduction of chiropractic, which approximately 105 years ago. Now, I have to say with absolute, total, and full confidence that the big single issue for me in this millennium is the fact that this is our time. And I say that with absolute confidence, with no hesitation at all. I absolutely believe that this is our time. That all the historical incidences that have come together, the psychological aspects of society, all these things, the introduction of Eastern mysticism into our society, the direction that physics is taking, all these things indicate to me that this is basically our time. I was talking to Paula Hegelon in the beginning of the week, and in the conversation, she asked me the following question. She said to me, "Tell me the truth. Do you really think that chiropractic is in trouble? That maybe because there are so few of us that believe in the principle, that we are too small a part of society to make any difference, that perhaps we really are in trouble?" And my answer to her was, no, I don't think chiropractic is in trouble at all. I think maybe chiropractors are in trouble, but I don't think chiropractic is in trouble, because chiropractic is an idea. It's an idea that we materialize through something called practice. But in its purest form, it's an idea, a concept, a way of looking at the world, not a way of looking at the healing arts, but a way of looking at the world. We take the concept of a universal intelligence, and then from this very broad concept of universal intelligence, narrow the focus down to each individual and introduce into each individual a personalization of this universal intelligence and call it innate intelligence. Now, this innate intelligence is beyond what we can see. Universal intelligence cannot be touched or seen or sensed. It has no color, it has no weight, it has no size. In fact, I don't even think it operates in the aspects of time. I think it is beyond time, and it is beyond space. It is something greater than both time and space. And I was thinking about this after I talked to her, and I said to myself, you know, we look at ourselves as being of the earth. We look at ourselves as being earthlings. And to a great degree, it's going to, the definition is going to be what we describe or what we end up defining as who we are. See, all living things have life force. That's what makes them living. But again, even with life force, you cannot measure it. You can only see the manifestation of it. You can only see the way it manifests itself, and it manifests itself through matter and through time. But in itself, in order to be able to describe, to be able to define life force, you can't define it. You know, the argument is, well, it manifests itself as electromagnetic energy in human beings, for example, and you're absolutely right, it does. But this is the manifestation of it. This is not what it is. This is how it manifests itself. Well, where does life force come from? If we are innate intelligence, and as innate intelligence utilize something called life force in order to animate matter, us. If the matter that we animate is literally the earth, in other words, what we are is the earth. There isn't a part of you that is not earth. That's all it is. It's you have reconstructed the earth into something called yourself, called the human being. But that's not you. That's what you've reconstructed. The you, which is your innate in combination with your life force, where does this come from? Well, it comes from the same place that gravity comes from. It comes from the same place that the strong and the weak forces that the physicists talk about come from. These forces were present at the instant of creation, therefore come from creation. And since they were present at the instant of creation, they are the manifestation of the Creator, whatever the Creator is, in your particular estimation. So where do you come from? Where does your innate come from? Where does your manifestation of life force come from? It comes from the Creator. You are not, it does not come from the earth. It manifests itself in the earth, but does not come from the earth. It comes from the Creator. It is part of the original creative process. Now, if you look at it from this particular point of view, which I think is the only way you can possibly look at it, then it puts a completely different aspect on what our relationship as chiropractors is towards our patients, who we now look at as being animated earth, manifested by an innate intelligence and a life force that came directly from the Creator. So our relationship with the individual is one that places us now on a relationship with the Creator. When something happens to an individual that now causes a disorganization of the animation of earth in that human body, then literally what's happening is that the normal ability of that innate intelligence, of that little bit of creation, of that little bit of creative force that has the ability to manifest and control something called life force, is being interfered with, so it cannot organize the earth into a human being that fits into the time and space that human being should be in its particular position and its particular environment on the earth. Now, when this happens, this has a great many names. It's called disease, it's called illness, it's called sickness, it's called insanity, it's called murder, it's called many, many names. But the names merely describe the abnormality that is occurring in the human being. That's all. The abnormality is what's important. What caused the abnormality? To merely name the abnormality and then attempt to do something to cover up the abnormality merely does just that. It covers up the abnormality. What is important is to be able to understand what caused the abnormality, and the cause of the abnormality is always, in every circumstance, the inability of that particular human being's innate intelligence to express itself through its life force and organize itself in such a way that it functions normally in the environment in which it is. The idea of one cause, one disease, one cure is valid. I would change it to one cause, one condition, one cure. Because again, I don't particularly care for the term disease, because that only describes something in a medical mode, and I don't even want to do that. I think the farther we get away from describing anything in medical terms in this new millennium that we're in, the better off we're going to be. So it's one cause, one condition, and then one cure. And what's the cure? The cure is always the same thing. It can be nothing else other than one cure. And we're going to talk about more about that in a little bit here, because there's some things I want to go over with you. But the cure is always the same. The cure is the ability of innate intelligence to manifest itself totally and completely in that individual. And how do we get that to happen? We remove whatever it is that's interfering with that. Now, you remember the triune of life. You remember that the triune of life, being a triangle, has three legs. The top leg is intelligence, which is innate intelligence. The second leg is life force, which is the force that innate uses to organize. The third leg, which is matter. So innate intelligence utilizes its life force to reorganize the atoms of the particular individual. And when it's able to do that successfully, that particular individual, who is the triune, now functions normally in the environment. Let's, for example, just to briefly, I know we've done this before, but just to go over it for those folks who have not heard it before. If, you know, the perfect example of this is always, is, and I like to use the carrot seed. He said the carrot seed is a seed, right, that has in it potential life. It does not have, at the time it is a seed, the active manifestation of life force. It has potential life. Now, in order to take this potential life and manifest it into an organizing life, we have to do certain things. And the thing that we have to do is give it a soil on which it can live and survive, provide the sunshine necessary and the water necessary for it to function. And if we do those three things, give it a soil to be able to manifest itself and make sure it gets enough water and make sure it gets enough sunshine, it will become a carrot. Now the question is always, how does a carrot seed become a carrot? Well, if we go back, we can understand it very quickly if we go back to the triune. The innate intelligence of the carrot uses its life force to reorganize the atoms of soil and water into atoms of carrot. Now, again, remember atoms. Atoms don't care what they are. Atoms are like a pile of bricks. You can take this pile of bricks and you can build a wall. You can take this pile of bricks and you can build a sidewalk. You can take this pile of bricks and you can build a house. You can take this pile of bricks and build whatever you want. The bricks will still be the bricks. The end result you get is totally dependent on how you organize these bricks. You see? It's the same with atoms. What you get from the atoms that are in the universe totally depend on how you organize the atoms. Well, if the innate intelligence of the carrot takes the atoms that are now organized in water and soil and whatever, and takes and breaks that down, and then reorganizes the atoms in carrot, what you get is a carrot. Same atoms that were in the soil and the water, but now reorganized into something called carrot. Now, if you consume the carrot, say I eat the carrot, Richard J. Santo eats the carrot. Go back to the triune again. Richard J. Santo's innate intelligence uses his life force now to reorganize the atoms of the carrot into atoms of Richard J. Santa. I do the same thing that the carrot did. All life does exactly the same thing. All innate intelligences that exist in whatever universe we know about anyway does one thing. It utilizes life force to reorganize atoms to its benefit. And if it does this successfully, then the organism in which it is doing it, right, operates to its fullest potential. It's as simple as that. Health is nothing more than the successful reorganization of atoms into an entity that can survive successfully in the environment in which it's in. That's all. Now, if you interfere with this process, if you take away any of the legs of that triangle, if you somehow destroy the innate intelligence, and the only way I could think you would do that would be to murder the individual, or you interfere with the innate intelligence being able to utilize the life force, or the innate ability of the life force to reorganize the atoms by blocking the manifestation of these things in the communication systems of the organism, which in our case is the nervous system, then you change the ability of this particular individual to be able to accomplish the things that the triune are able to accomplish. And as a result of that, he becomes less than he can be in the environment in which he lives. And in that case, the environment will overwhelm him. And when the environment overwhelms him, this is called medically disease. But again, I don't even want to think of it in that term. All I want to do is think of it in terms that the environment is overwhelming him. And if the environment can overwhelm him sufficiently enough, it results in his inability to now organize atoms at all, and that's called death. So the function of the chiropractor, in this picture, of course, is to find where the interference is, remove the interference, so that innate manifests itself as cleanly and as clearly and as perfectly as it possibly can. And when it is able to do this again, the particular biological entity, right, now can function successfully in its environment. Now, universal intelligence, on the other hand, is not interested particularly in any one given organism. What it is interested in is balance. What it wants, what it attempts to accomplish, is to have all the forms of energy that exist in its universe to be balanced. And in this balance is what holds the universe together. It's what creates the environment that allows the universe to function. And the universe functions in very violent ways. You've got these enormously burning globes of hot gases that are suns and stars that exist in the sky. You've got violent situations called black holes that suck entire universes into themselves. You've got the forces of gravity fighting the sources of other forces, centrifugal forces and whatever. You've got all these things going on at the same time that if they were not balanced, the universe would collapse on itself and would disappear. But all for every force that exists, there is an opposite contracting force that balances it, which enables the universe to remain reasonably stable. Although it looks like it's chaotic, if from a short-term look, it is from the long-term look extremely stable. They use these the same example. If you're in a helicopter at 9:05 over Wall Street in New York, looking down at Wall Street, what you would see is hundreds of thousands of people scurrying on the street. It would look like a bunch of ants who were lost and running in random directions. But at 9:05, if you look at the street is reasonably clear because what looked like chaos was actually order because each one of those people were going to their office, coming from different directions, which made it look like it was chaotic, but going to their particular places of business. And they all got there. So there was order in what appeared to be chaos. And it's the same in the universe. Even though the universe appears to be chaotic, it isn't really order. Because we don't have the capacity to look at it from the long term, because none of us can live that long. So all we can see is the short-term versions of it, which give the appearance of chaotic, but in reality are not. So universal intelligence now is interested in balance. the innate intelligence is also interested in balance, but it is also interested in the survival of the entity in which it manifests itself. For example, you come in contact with another life form. Let's go one step before that. You have a lion and you have a gazelle or an elk or whatever. The lion is the predator and hunts the elk, right? Universal intelligence is not interested in who wins that battle. It's not interested in whether the elk gets away and the lion goes hungry, or the lion catches the elk and the elk dies. Because it knows that that will eventually balance out, that the relationship of elks to lions will stay the same, because a certain percentage of lions are going to, a certain percentage of lions are going to catch elk, and a certain percentage of elks are always going to get away. So the relationship stayed there. There was a very interesting experiment that was on that was created on a island in the western, off the western part of Canada, in which wolves were introduced on this particular island. And what happened was there was an observation made as to whether or not the wolves would kill off the other animals on the island and change the ecology of the island. And what happened was that no matter how many kills there were, the relationship of other animals to wolves always stayed the same. In other words, if the wolves were starting to kill too many of the animals off, for some reason, the birth rate of the wolves would drop, so that there would be less wolves. If the population of the animals increased, then the wolf birth rate would increase. Excuse me. So that this innate balance always took place. You can project this into almost all living things on the earth. For example, eels spawn off the coast of North America. Now, the eels around North America come from various parts of the East Coast, but eels also come to the North American continent from Europe. Now, they all get here at the same time, which means that the eels coming from Europe have to leave a week or so earlier because they literally are going to swim the ocean. But the timing is such that all of them get here at the same time. Now, how do they know to do this? They know to do this because they are intimately connected to universal intelligence. And in order for the balance to keep itself, they would have to do this. So the balance takes place. Universal intelligence takes care of what's going on, and it occurs. It's the same with us. We are predators, for example, are viruses and bacteria. I mean, not many of us come in contact with lions and tigers. So our predators are basically bacteria and viruses. Now, bacteria and viruses become killers of man the same way that wolves and tigers and lions become killers of other animals. The animals that they eliminate from the flocks and from the herds are those that are weakest. The humans that bacteria and viruses eliminate from the human race are those humans that are weakest. So, from the point of view of universal intelligence, this is balance. Now, from our particular position, because we have something called emotional involvement, we look at this and we say that this is terrible, that these old and sick people end up dying from this condition, and we do everything we can to keep them alive, which literally, from the point of view of universal intelligence, is throwing the balance out of whack. But again, we have something called an emotional involvement that almost forces us to take this particular position. But it's not personal. In other words, the bacteria aren't killing people personally. They are predators. That's all they do. They're doing their natural thing. They are eliminating the weaker species. They are eliminating the species that would prevent man from becoming less than what he could become. Just like every time the mountain lion or the wolf pulls down a deer that is weak and sick, right? it prevents that deer from reproducing in the herd and producing deer that would, or elk or whatever, that would be weak and sick. So, you know, it's just part of the natural pattern. But we have, again, we have so emotionalized this by creating this whole concept of disease that we look at this in a totally different way now. Now, I'm not in any way, shape, or form advocating that we should let the weak and the sick in our populations die. All I'm saying is that this is natural law. And whether we like it or not, it's natural law. Now, I want to get into something else here that ties into this, but we're going to kind of take a long walk around to the back door to get into this. When I was in the service, when I was in the Army, I was the night man in a dispensary. I ran a dispensary in Germany. And I had this soldier come to see me, who came to the dispensary, complaining of violent headaches. I mean, really violent headaches. Vomiting, almost blind, just absolute violent. And he had been, I knew from his 8-4 record, which was his medical record, that he had been there during the daytime and they had given him rather heavy medication in order to try to stop his headaches, but that nothing was working for him. So what I did was sitting down and decide to give him a placebo. Now, I want you to listen to my language now because I'm going to change language as we go into this thing. But for now, we'll just use the term placebo. I gave him a placebo. What I did was go in a bag, take some capsules from the pharmacy, empty them out, and I literally made a sugar pill. All I did was take some granular sugar, put it in, and put the thing together. And I gave him two, but I put them first in a small pill envelope, sealed it, and wrote on it, destroy unused pill. Put this in another envelope and gave it to him with the instructions that these were very, very strong pills. And that one would do the trick. I was going to give him two just in case, but I did not think he would need to. But he had to give me his word he would flush the other one down the toilet if he did not use it. And he did. He gave me his word that he would do this. And he left. Well, he reported back to sick call the next morning, and he told the doctors that the pill I had given him was the first thing that had worked, and that he had slept all night, and he had not had any head pain. Well, this occurred two or three more times in the 6 months that I had this particular job. Now, before we go any further, the first question in your mind should be, why didn't I adjust him? And the answer to that is very simple. The answer to that is that I was a mechanistic chiropractor at the time and would not even make the connection of being able to adjust somebody with a headache. So as a result of that, it never crossed my mind. Now, it didn't bother me, but I was just so curious over the fact that why had this thing worked so successfully for me? I'd given him these tablets, and every time I gave them the tablets, they had the same effect. The headache went away, he felt fine, he slept all night. And he never ever had to say second tablet, but he always made sure he flushed the second tablet down the toilet because it was such a powerful drug. Well, it was a very interesting article in today's Times. And it's called A Placebo Prescription. And I'm just going to read a little bit to you on this, and then we're going to talk about it. Because I think that it's important. Because we are going to be approached with this. Chiropractic is going to be approached with this kind of a concept. And we're going to have to be able to discuss it intelligently. And we're going to have to be able to take a position on it, which explains our relationship to this. So that people understand exactly what our relationship is, so there's no confusion. And we'll talk about this on the other side. Okay, we're on placebo prescription. Now, in the article states, the little experiment. And what they did, they took 10 men, and they were going to, who had volunteered for a study that had to do with an operation to relieve the arthritis pain in their knees. And then it said, for a while, two of the men would undergo the standard arthroscopic surgery for their condition, the scraping and rinsing of the knee joint. And three would have the rinsing alone. Five would have no recognized surgical procedure at all. Their surgery would be a placebo, an exercise, and just pretend. In other words, five of them, they were just going to cut the skin so that they would appear that they were operated on. Now, the doctor did not know which one of these patients until the patient was brought in and he had an envelope and he opened the envelope and it told him, yeah, this guy got the arthroscopic surgery, yeah, this guy just got his knee rinsed, yeah, this guy just got a slice made on his skin. And none of the patients knew who would have what. Now, I said the placebo worked. 6 months after the surgery, 10 patients still didn't know whether they had been faked out or not. But all of them reported much less pain. None were unhappy with the outcome of the operation. And it talks about one of the men by the name of Colligan. And he says, he does not know that his surgery consisted of only shallow incisions. More important, he knows that he has no pain in his knee now, and that he can mow his yard again, and he can walk wherever he wants. The surgery was 2 years ago, and the knee has never bothered me since. Now, further on, he goes, 40 years ago, a young Seattle cardiologist named Leonard Cobb conducted a unique trial of a procedure then commonly used for angina, in which doctors made small incisions in the chest and tied knots in two arteries to try to increase blood flow to the heart. It was a popular technique. 90% of the patients reported that it helped. But when Cobb compared it with placebo surgery, in which he made incisions but did not tie off the arteries, the sham operation proved just as successful. To go on, it said doctors investigating a new technique for Parkinson's disease, for example, incorporated a placebo control group. Patients who had holes drilled in their skulls to stimulate the real procedure, in which fetal cells are implanted in the brain, into a widely publicized study released last April. The study showed a significant placebo effect. Goes on to say, the truth is that the placebo effect is huge. Anywhere between 35 and 75% of patients benefit from taking a dummy pill in studies of new drugs. So huge, in fact, that it should probably be put to conscious use in clinical practice, even if we do not entirely understand how it works. For centuries, Western medicine consisted of almost nothing but the placebo effect. The patient who got better after a bleeding or a dose of fox lung, wood lice, tartar emetic, or any other charming staples of the 19th century pharmacopoeia got better either in spite of them or because of their symbolic value. Since patients believed in the cure and in the authority of the bigwig gentleman administering it, and the belief gave them hope, the hope made them well. In an influential article first published in 1955, the Harvard researcher Henry Beecher concluded that between 30 and 40% of any treated group would respond to a placebo. But studies since then have showed the placebo working for certain conditions, pain, depression, heart ailments, gastric ulcers, stomach complaints, is closer to 50 or 60% of subjects, sometimes more. Indeed, it is not unheard of for the placebo effect to exceed those attributed to the active drug. And strangely, the placebo effect is not limited to the subjective sensations of patients. Some studies show actual physiological changes as a result of sham treatments. Doctors in one study successfully eliminated warts by tainting them with a brightly colored, inert dye and promising patients the warts would be gone when the color wore off. In a study of asthmatics, researchers found that they could produce dilation of the airwaves by simply telling people they were inhaling a bronchodilator, even when they weren't. Patients suffering pain after wisdom tooth extractions got just as much relief from a fake application of ultrasound as from a real one, so long as both the patient and the therapist thought the machine was on. 52% of colitis patients treated with placebo in 11 different trials reported feeling better. And 50% of the inflamed intestines actually looked better when assessed with a sphygmomanoscope. In fact, some studies now being released are suggesting that all depression medication may be a sham, simply because the placebos they give with the studies on these particular depression medications, the placebo have the same recovery effect as the depression medication does. Now, it goes on to say, or to talk about, what the doctor says is just as important as the actual application of the treatment. It said Thomas tried a little experiment on 200 patients in his own practice who came to see him feeling under the weather, but with no abnormal physical signs. Thomas gave one group of patients a definite diagnosis and told them they'd be better in a few days. He told the other that he couldn't be sure what was the matter with them, and so couldn't say when their symptoms would clear up. 2 weeks later, 64% of the patients who received the encouraging consultation had gotten better, compared with 39% in the other group. We are definitely going to talk about that later. Now, it goes on later in the article to describe that what the doctor thinks is just as important. A study done at the University of Michigan at Dearborn came up with the following findings. If a physician thinks a new drug is the greatest thing since sliced bread, or if he's really excited about a new theory, it always makes a difference. That's one reason why the effectiveness of older drugs often wanes when a new one comes out. We're going to talk about that too. But I want to get into this placebo thing, because one of the other things he brings out is the fact that one of the arguments then with all these new findings on placebos is the fact that anything that they now, these people, classify as alternative care, which they now have always said was a placebo effect, is so effective because placebos work. And what they're going to say is that what we do really does not have any value as far as true change is concerned, but is in reality a placebo effect. Well, our arguments on this are really very simple. And what it has to do with is what I like to talk about in these tapes quite a bit. What it has to do with is the choice of language. The first thing we have to get rid of here is the term placebo. Just like the PR companies that handle drug companies came up with the term side effect when dealing with a particular drug, the term placebo falls into the same category. There is no such thing as a side effect. There is only an effect. Drugs do not have front effects, back effects, side effects. They only have effects. So if a drug company says one of the side effects of this particular drug is to cause gastrointestinal bleeding, what they are really saying is that one of the effects of this drug is gastrointestinal bleeding. You see? But we now buy into the idea of side effect as a result, we say, well, this is a very good drug. However, it has a certain amount of side effect. Baloney! This drug has these following effects. Da-dum, 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 and gastrointestinal bleeding. Now, if you watch television now, and you watch the drug companies now who are advertising directly to the public on television, the FDA makes them also list, quote, the what they consider to be the side effects. But I've watched these commercials very carefully. And these people are so clever, they should get Academy Awards for cleverness. Whenever they talk about the side effects of the drug, or the adverse effects of the drug, what you see on the television is a smiling person. A young girl and a young boy, or a young man and a young woman embracing and smiling at each other, or an older woman sitting, gazing out the window, or gazing at her grandchildren, just smiling and just full of joy and happiness. And at the same time, in the background, he's reading, you know, may cause hemorrhoids, may cause your tongue to fall out, your ears may clog, your nose may fall off, you know. But they know from experience that almost 60% of any experience is visual, while only 30% of any experience is visual. So 60% of what's going on in your interpretation of the commercial is a smiling person, and only 30% is listening to what's going on in the background telling you what the side effects are. Which is why the actor in the commercial is never the one that tells you what the adverse effects are. It's always a background voice somewhere. And as a result of that, they manipulate through words and through images what they want. Which is, in effect, its own placebo effect, if we want to use the term. Now, let's go back to placebo. If you take a particular chemical substance, and then you take something that they consider to be a placebo, which I'm not going to call a placebo now, but I'm going to call another chemical substance, because it could be sugar, but sugar is a chemical, right? Or it could be baking soda or whatever, but another chemical substance. And the person who is giving the particular placebo does not know which is which, or does not even know that one is a placebo. And with the enthusiasm of someone who is trying to help someone else, and thinks he has a chemical that will do that particular thing, now gives it to a patient who believes and has faith in the particular individual who's giving him the chemical, then the faith and belief between those two individuals is what's going to make the change, in combination with the actual act of the patient swallowing the pill. The act of swallowing the pill, the faith of the patient in the doctor, the faith of the doctor in the pill, now creates an environment in which something quite magnificent happens. Now, the doctor has an innate intelligence. The patient has an innate intelligence. Everyone's innate intelligence is interrelated with everyone else's innate intelligence. You remember the time when I talked about the experiments in physics with the concepts of universal intelligence and the concept of universal intelligence as described by physicists is as follows. Everything in the universe knows what everything else in the universe is doing. If the innate intelligence of the doctor is able to contact and influence the innate intelligence of the patient, and the way this is done is always with emotion, then the innate intelligence of the patient will make the necessary changes in the chemistry of the body of the patient to produce the effects that the suggestion has made to it. How do we know this? We know this through something as simple as hypnotism. If the only way a patient is hypnotized is because they think that the person who is hypnotizing them can hypnotize them on some level. Anyway, they may consciously say, nah, you can't, I don't believe you can hypnotize me, da da da, boom, and they're out, right? Because on another non-conscious level, they believe that it really can happen, it does happen. As a result of that, the patient becomes hypnotized. The hypnotist now takes a piece of ice and tells the patient now that it is a red-hot poker and runs the ice along the patient's arm. The patient now will produce the physiological properties necessary to protect itself from the hot poker. And what will appear on the patient's arm is a burn. Because the patient's innate, which at this point has been interfered with, will create the circumstances necessary to be able to produce the physiological and chemical changes necessary to defend itself against the red hot poker. So we know that there is this relationship between all of us. So it's not, has nothing to do with placebo. What it has to do with is belief systems. And again, if you remember, if you've been to my lectures when we talk about the relationship of man being made up to himself, the creation of man to himself by his innate, innate basically flows through two filters. And the two filters it flows through are something called the experience filter and the belief system filter. The experience and the belief now that innate flows through creates the particular kind of individual that you are. Your experience, your belief creates the unique individual that you are, which what makes you different than the other individual standing across the room from you who is created by innate flowing through their experience and their belief system filters. Now, let me talk to you about, we go back and talk a little bit about this idea of the, how much the doctor believes and what's going on. Those of you who have been around a little bit and will attest to the following, and because you know this is exactly the way it works. You meet one of your colleagues and you say to him, what's new? He said to me, I just went out and I took the ABC technique course. And you say, yeah, how was it? And he says, man, I can't tell you. This guy got it down. He's got the angle of drive down. You make this kind of analysis. You do this. Bang, you hit him. I'm telling you, I got people getting off the table. I mean, they're hugging me. They're kissing me. They're telling me they never felt this good in their life. It is, you know. So you decide to go to take the ABC course. And the man who's teaching, or the teacher who's teaching the ABC course now, is enthusiastic and about his, the particular presentation he's making and the technique that he's discovered. And you catch this enthusiasm from him, and the thing makes sense to you, and it looks, and it just seems fantastic, and you go home, and sure enough, you get the same kind of, I mean, people are getting up, hugging, kissing you, telling you, my Lord, I never felt this good. Boy, am I glad you went to get this technique, this, that, and the other thing. Now, fast forward about 6, 7, 8 months. All of a sudden now, this technique now is giving you about the same kind of results you had from the technique you had before you went to take this technique. What happened? Your enthusiasm waned. That's all. Our enthusiasm for anything new over a period of time decreases. And your enthusiasm decreased. As your enthusiasm decreased, the effects you were getting, the benefits you were getting from that particular technique now, also started to wane. So one of the most important things we as a doctor of chiropractic have as a responsibility to our patients is to make sure that we are enthusiastic and excited about what we do in the office. See, I always tell this to young chiropractors. You know, I'll adjust a young chiropractor and they'll say to me, you know, gee, thanks, doc, that was a great adjustment. And I'll say, and I always say to them, you know what your greatest misfortune is And they'll say to me, what? And I'll say, and if you can't believe this, then we really have to talk. And they'll say, well, what do you mean? And I'll say, your greatest misfortune is that you cannot, or you have to feel your greatest misfortune is the fact that you cannot adjust yourself. Because unless you feel that you are the best chiropractor around, unless you feel that the best thing you could ever do for yourself would be to be able to adjust yourself because you are able to do this so well, unless you cannot feel that way about yourself, then the relationship between you and your patients is not what it should be. And it will never be that until you feel that way. Because once you feel that way, you now transmit this to your patient. And your patients come into your presence now, and they sense this. And they now, their belief system now is prepared to accept you and accept what you do. Once they're able to do this, you are now, through your adjustment, able to affect their experience filter, which is their nervous system, and remove the interference to the transmission of innate. Innate now flows through the experience, through the belief, and that individual changes. Not only changes, but the amount of change becomes remarkable. You start getting these miracle cases. And the miracle cases now start to respond. They start to become your norm rather than your exception. And you start attracting the people with the cancers and the asthmas and the God knows what start looking for you. They start searching you out. Because your ability to affect their belief system, your ability to affect their nervous system through something that I refer to as the experience filter now, enables innate to flow unimpeded through this particular individual. You see? So what the medics are calling placebo really isn't placebo. There's no such thing as placebo, just like there's no such thing as side effect. There is only effect. And just like there is the relationship to therapy or the relationship to adjustment or the relationship to treatment depending on what your discipline and your philosophy is always the same. It is just the patient's response to whatever it is that you're doing. And again, to use the medical situation as the example, it doesn't make any difference what the chemical is. It makes no difference what the chemical is. See, now for them, in order to be able to make some sort of sense out of this, to be able to justify their particular science and philosophy and art, right? They have to call it something or create an idea about it, and the idea that they've created about it is a placebo effect. So if somebody ever approaches you and says, well, you know, a big benefit of chiropractic is its placebo effect, you say to them, there's no such thing as a placebo effect. The idea of a placebo effect is an error in thinking. There is only effect. And chiropractic produces an effect. And this effect is determined by the skill of the chiropractor, the enthusiasm of the chiropractor, the ability of the chiropractor to transmit the information about what he is going to do, what is wrong with the patient, what the patient can expect, and his enthusiasm about his ability to help the patient regain his ability to be everything he can do by releasing the flow of innate in this individual, and the ability of the patient to accept what the doctor says, to accept in full enthusiasm what the doctor says, now, creates the proper attitude and mode for the most successful experience to occur between the chiropractor and the patient. This is why even the orientations are so important. I mean, where else do you have such an absolute, total, complete opportunity to show the patient what you're going to do, to be able to explain to the patient what's going on in their case, to be able to show the patient the wonders of chiropractic, and to do this with an enthusiasm that ignites the room, that gets the patient excited about the fact that he has found the person who he really wants to come to, who he has found the person who has the solution to his problems. No placebo. Placebo is nonsense. It doesn't exist. Now, I know, just from the tone of this article, that we're going to start hearing a lot about this in the next year. That this is shaking medical roots, and they have to now create a defense for this. And what they're going to say, well, if the pills are like that, then everything else is like that too. And all these other harebrained things like acupuncture and chiropractic and are all placebo, and our answer has got to be immediate, it's got to be direct, and it's got to be distinct, and we have to attack the entire concept of placebo. Just, and we can attack it with logic the same way we can attack the idea that there is no such thing as a side effect of a drug. The fact that I read this article the first Sunday of the millennium is also what makes me so excited about the fact that this is our time. I mean, what I'm looking at here with this particular article is the fact that medicine now is losing the base on which it's standing. Its foundation is crumbling. Our foundation is getting infinitely stronger. But we have to be enthusiastic about the fact that it's getting stronger. We have to have courage about the fact that it's getting stronger. Now, it doesn't make any difference how few of us there are. That doesn't even enter into the picture. There are few of us that went to Panama. Look what we did in Panama. There are few people that went to Haiti. Look what they did in Haiti. There are few people went to Jamaica. Look what they did in Jamaica. There are few people went to Russia. Look what they did in Russia. You understand? It doesn't make any difference how many chiropractors there are, as long as these chiropractors are filled with enthusiasm, have a mission in life, are willing to step out to that mission, and willing to step out in full faith, full enthusiasm, full knowledge of the fact that they're doing absolutely the right thing, the full concept of the fact that they now, and only they, have the ability to affect the innate intelligence of this particular individual so that they now can be as perfect as they can be. And with the idea that they are not going to allow anything to stop them from doing this. Once that occurs, once we walk out with that kind of enthusiasm, once we walk out with that kind of situation, then it will become evident to everyone, it will become evident to all of society that our time has come. Our time has come. And what we have to look for this year, and in the coming years, are opportunities to be able to do this. We have to look at opportunities to go to other countries and turn on the life in other countries, to turn on the flow of innate intelligence in other countries. And what we have to do is look for opportunities to explain to people what we do, to explain the concept of innate intelligence, to explain the concept of the subluxation. And if people don't want to hear it, then we shake our dust off our shoes and we move on to another group and tell them. We don't waste time with people who don't want to hear. We just talk to people who do want to hear. And that group of people that we talk to that do want to hear will get larger and larger and larger and larger and larger and larger. Until eventually we become the focal point of the 21st century when it comes to a new and dynamic paradigm of healing. And when I use the term healing, I don't mean merely the treatment of some sort of illness. I mean healing of not the body, but healing of the human being, of the entire human being, so that humankind now becomes better. It's our time. It's our turn. Everything points in our direction. Let's do this. The innate in me blesses the innate in you. Peace.